Good thing is disconcerting, to say the least. Who wants to identify with that? Who would not rather identify with an earthquake or a jutting cliff? Aren't these grand, sublime aspects of nature the stuff of poetry? They are indeed. That's the point of rejecting them here. We're being asked to imagine what the world looks like if we invert a scale of values we thought immutable, unchallengeable. And if we can do it for a metaphor, perhaps we can do it for what the metaphor represents. Ultimately, the greatness of Sordello lies in this revolutionary invitation to imagine a new order of things. But the invitation is, alas, uninviting. "I look at you every day as a monkey does at a coconut," Ruskin once wrote to Browning, having great faith in the milk, hearing it rattle indeed, inside, but quite beside myself for the fibres. The fibres of Sordello have grown, if anything, tougher and huskier with the years. It is certainly capable of making monkeys of its readers. But for anyone brave enough to crack the toughest nut in English poetry, I guarantee that the milk is still inside.
The Greatest Poem Never Read was presented by Danny Carlin and produced in Bristol by Tim Dee. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall and the second part of this proms performance of Bach's B minor Mass, given by the choir and orchestra of the English Concert, conducted by Harry Bickett. Earlier on, I spoke to Harry Bickett and he talked about the sheer pleasure of performing this music, despite the many challenges of presenting it here in the Royal Albert Hall.
It's music of such genius. One of the great beauties of this piece is that no one I know of my orchestra or choir or any of the soloists ever tire of returning to it again and again and again. So in a way, that part of my job is easy. The physical difficulties of playing it are something else. And obviously in a space as big as the Albert Hall, taking a piece that has a certain sort of virtuosity, which is easier to achieve with smaller forces, trying to do that with the larger forces in such a huge space requires simple technical problems of the chorus being about half a mile away from me, trying to coordinate the bassoons that are a quarter of a mile away from them. But I love listening to Bach on the piano. I love doing the Bach B minor Mass with huge forces. I love doing it with small forces. The music transcends all of this.
Tonight's conductor, Harry Bickett. We rejoin the B minor Mass for the Credo. The avowal of Christian faith is a movement unbelieving composers have been known to leave out altogether. Not Bach, of course, the devout Lutheran for whom it amounts to half the duration of the entire Mass. At the centre of the Credo are the trio of movements concerned with Christ's incarnation, crucifixion and resurrection. It emerges as the most moving and dramatic sequence of the whole Mass, as perhaps it should be. After the sombre, drooping phrases of the Crucifixus, Bach shatters the stillness with an explosion of ecstatic joy, for et resurrexit, and the third day he rose again. The next movement, the Sanctus, Holy, 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 Lord God of Hosts, is a conspicuous example of Bach's compulsive number symbolism. The word Sanctus is repeated three times in the liturgy, three times in the music, which is also shot through with triplets. The entire fabric sways in glorious propulsion, an extended shout of triumph for the choir, underpinned by pealing trumpets and exuberant timpani. The Sanctus goes straight into the Hosanna in Excelsis, and the final section of this mighty work sets the Agnus Dei for a solo voice and the Dona Nobis Pacem for the choir, whose music's identical to the Gratias, the thanksgiving section of the glory of this very work, a masterstroke of economy and a profound piece of theological symbolism. Here's Harry Bickett once again with the soloists, Joel Harvey, Justin Davis, Ed Lyon and Matthew Rose, to continue this proms performance of Bach's B minor Mass.
Thank you. In spiritum sanctum dominum et vivificante. Et in spiritum sanctum dominum et vivificante. Vivificante, Spiritum Sanctum, Vivificante Dominum, qui ex Padre Filio, quae Cum Patre fetas, locutus est pebro fetas, pebro fetas, locutus est. Locutus est pebro fetas, locutus est pebro fetas, pebro fetas. Et unam sanctam catholicam et apostolicam ecclesiam. Et unam sanctam catholicam et apostolicam ecclesiam, et unam sanctam catholicam et apostolicam ecclesiam, unam sanctam catholicam et apostolicam ecclesiam.
the final Agnus Dei and Dona Nobis Pacem of Bach's B minor Mass. The last bass entry in the chorus, reinforced so spectacularly by the drums, which have been silent for a long while, seeming to defy disbelief and proclaim unquenchable faith, which Bach surely needed, his death only a year away at the time he composed that music. Well, maybe not quite the wall of sound which greeted those women rowers, but an impressive noise here in the Royal Albert Hall for that performance. The soloists in Bach's B minor Mass were Joel Hardy, Yestin Davis, Ed Lyon, and Matthew Rose. In his case, singing the bass part for the first time, with the choir of the English concert and the instrumentalists of the English concert leader, Nadia Zwina. The performance conducted by Harry Bickett. When I spoke to him earlier, he said that some of Bach's music is so complex, so difficult to perform. You look at certain lines and think he must have had superhuman singers who could perform that without taking a breath. Sometimes Bickett says he just wrote, "This is what my offering is." As human beings, if we can perform it, then I think we somehow get closer to godliness. Soloists returning to the platform with Harry Bickett, greeted by those tremendous cheers. 6 weeks ago, on the 17th of June, they performed the Mass. That roar for the choir of the English concert. They performed the Mass in Bach's own church, St. Thomas's. Then they were rather slenderer in number, just four to a part tonight. For the more spacious acoustic of the Royal Albert Hall, seven to a part. There's cheers for Katerina Schreckelsen and Hannah McLaughlin, the oboists, flautist Lisa Vesnosiuk and Guy Williams, trumpeters Mark Bennett, Michael Harrison and Michael Laird. A cheer for Nadia Zwina. And we shouldn't forget the man standing throughout playing the organ, Benjamin Bale. Cheer there for Jonathan Crouch, who spoke very amusingly in the pre-prom talk, telling us that to convey the changes of rhythm to his colleagues in the section, he'd be bouncing about like Boris Johnson on a zip wire. Well, you can hear tonight's concert, as all the proms, online for 7 days after the event, using the Listen Again facility, highly recommended. That's just to mention that Composer of the Week, which has been featuring the Bach B minor Mass movement by movement, reaches its end tomorrow at 12. But for now, time for me to hand you back to Jonathan Swain in Broadcasting House.
Donald, thank you there. Donald MacLeod there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to add, there's another chance to hear that joyous performance of the B minor Mass here on BBC Radio 3 on Friday afternoon next week at 2 o'clock. Well, a slightly later start time for tomorrow night's prom. It brings that most intimate of Wagner pieces, the Siegfried Idyll, along with an Everest among symphonies, Bruckner's Eighth, with Donald Runicles conducting the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. That's at 7:45 tomorrow night. And there's more Bruckner in next Tuesday night's prom.
On Radio 3 from the BBC Proms, Bruckner's Sixth Symphony. The BBC Philharmonic and its new principal conductor, Juanjo Mena, fresh from an acclaimed Proms debut earlier in the season. And the world premiere of a new work by a composer closely associated with the orchestra, James McMillan. Tuesday night, BBC Radio 3 at 7:30.
Yes, it should be good. You may remember Juanjo Mena's Bruckner Sixth Symphony with the BBC Philharmonic and a Radio 3 Live in concert a few weeks ago. A glorious performance, rhythmically alive, vivid in colour and paced to perfection. As David Fanning wrote afterwards in The Telegraph, "Rarely have I heard a Bruckner Sixth that displayed such masterful long-term vision, and never, I think, one that made the work seem so important." Their prom opens with Wagner's Tristan Prelude, followed by James McMillan's Credo, and the Bruckner Sixth Symphony is in the second half. That's next Tuesday night, live from the Royal Albert Hall, here on BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, starting at 7:30. As for the present, in just under 5 minutes, out in the world, a global gay history. Richard Coles continues his study of same-sex desire across the centuries. For the moment, Bruckner, on a smaller scale from his symphonies, one of his motets, a setting of the Ave Maria. The singers are the choir of the Deutsche Oper Berlin, conducted by a man who had Bruckner in his bones, Eugen Jochum. A setting of the Ave Maria by Bruckner. The singers were the choir of the Deutsche Oper Berlin, conducted by Eugen Jochum. And as I was saying, Bruckner's Eighth Symphony is in tomorrow night's prom, the prom itself starting at 8:15. This is BBC Radio 3. It's just gone 10 o'clock, and now Richard Coles continues his excavation of same-sex desire across the centuries In Out in the World, a Global Gay History, first broadcast last year. Tonight, in a programme which explores India, Polynesia and native North America, Richard's focus is on imperialism and its legacy. He starts, though, a little closer to home.
I'm standing practically nestled into the bosom of the Mother of Parliaments here in Westminster, Big Ben right behind me, and I'm outside Portcullis House, the modern office block just opposite Big Ben, where I'm joining a queue of people, a long queue of people, who are all the guests of the Speaker tonight at a reception in Parliament to launch a group called Kaleidoscope. Kaleidoscope aims to promote particularly justice and equality for lesbian and gay people in Africa and Asia, where there have been some quite extraordinarily hostile attitudes around issues of sexuality just lately. It's the launch night tonight, so I've come to meet some people here. One of the founders of Kaleidoscope is Lance Price.
In a lot of those countries, if you look around the world at the countries where there is still criminal sanctions, effectively just for being a homosexual, a lot of them are Commonwealth countries, and a lot of the legislation that remains in place is the legacy, if you like, of colonialism. The laws were first put onto the statute book when we, the British, and others were colonial powers.
When the ambitious European nations went out into the world in the era of colonial expansion, they found a startling, to them, range of sexual expression. In this programme, we'll look at how that encounter raises all kinds of questions about the relationship between sexuality and gender, about how the powerful impose their values on those whom they dominate, about the different ways people think of their bodies and how they're defined by them, questions which have proved remarkably persistent. Professor Bill Nafee of Aberdeen University.
I think it would be fair to say that there are almost no cultures that the British and the West more generally come in contact with during the era of colonialism, say from 1500 onwards, where they do not find same-sex behaviour tolerated. Openly tolerated in a way that they would never have allowed.
They discovered boy wives, they discovered different sorts of transvestism.
Professor Robert Aldrich of the University of Sydney.
They discovered societies such as that of Japan, where certain types of homosexual behavior were not just tolerated but celebrated. In pre-colonial North America, as well as in the South Pacific, there are third sex or third gender persons that did not fit into our categories.
The British and more generally Europeans perceive this activity at any level for any reason as a sign of gross immorality and degeneracy.
And did that give force to the desire to legislate?
Yes, getting rid of the inherent sort of weakness. These cultures are perceived to be somehow feminized. They've become non-masculine, and that needs to be beaten or bred out of them.
Gay Pride Parade in Delhi. In 2009, after years of campaigning by activists, India repealed Section 377 of its penal code, which criminalized sexual activity against the order of nature. It had been on the statute books for nearly 150 years and reflected, it seems, the attitudes of the British who brought it rather than the Indians who were bound by it. And that rather vague wording, against the order of nature, reflects a reality in which sexual practice and gender identity was complex.
For example, Kliba, Shanda, Pandaka, Napamsaka, Titya Pakriti, Varshadhara and Kashaba.
Dr. Shane Gannon of Mount Royal University in Calgary.
These very terms were pointing to a non-hegemonic form of sexuality. They were pointing to something that the British really didn't understand.
The most obvious example of where the British find a different mental world, which they simply are never able to grasp, is in India with the third gender, the not man, not woman, the Hijras. The British find this utterly incomprehensible and revolting.
Modern day Mumbai. Like a flower on landfill, in an area one step up from a slum, Abina Aher stands out. Dancer, makeup artist, choreographer, and dressed today in a kurta, a long tunic top just above the knees, a dupatta, a shoulder scarf, and traditional leggings. Heels, makeup complete the look, but what sort of look? For Abhina is neither male nor female.
I describe myself as a hijra. A hijra is somebody who's not male or female. It's a third gender.
Abhina has male genitals and male sexual partners. Her dress is definitely feminine, but not because she wants to identify or be identified as a woman.
Deep down the heart, the identification of gender comes as a third gender, not as a female. Because females are different than us. We are something different. We are completely different than a female.
Abhina felt different from a very early age.
My mother is a dancer, and my father was an instrument player. I picked up my dance and a rhythm from my mother and father, and I used to love to cross-dress.
During her college years, Abhina was deeply confused trying to work out who she was.
I did this performance in drag, and I slowly started thinking that I really like this. Whenever female clothes touch to my body, I feel nice. I feel myself. I feel it within my shoes. I started cross-dressing for some time and started realizing the fact that is, whenever I cross-dress, I feel inner happiness, I feel mental peace. I really adore this expression. All these signals were actually triggering in my mind and saying that is, I'm something different. It's just not about my sexuality, it's much more beyond that. I found out this group of hijras, and then I started staying with them, talking to them and understanding their perspective about life. And then on one day I decided that what I am, I am. I want to be the way I am.
Hijras live a defined and strictly codified way of life.
First rule that comes is that you have to grow your hair like a woman. You're not supposed to cut your hair. Second rule that comes is I can't shave. I have to pluck my hair from my face. Then you have to wear three clothes, which means teen kapda. If you are wearing Indian attire, either you can wear a salwar kameez, which is the Indian garment, or otherwise you have to wear a sari, which is a normal traditional sari. Other thing is that I have to wear a full clothes. I'm not supposed to show off my body.
Traditionally, hijras lived at an angle to the wider society, set apart and occupying a particular spiritual role.
If you have a childbirth, we will come to your place, we will bless the child, and we will do dancing and ceremony and all that sort of things. And in return, we will take some money from you to bless your child and bless your family. Because hijras are considered in India and other Asian countries divine, which is something which is very special. That was a classical work. If you look at the Indian culture, if you look at the Indian history, then hijras were at the superior powers. They were actually well-wishers of kings and queens. They used to take care of harems. So, and they were like really in a superior position. But after post-British invasion, hijras have been suppressed in the corner and they've been shunned down.
The Victorians just took one look at it and said, we don't care what you call it, that's sodomy.
Professor Bill Nafee.
In many ways, the Victorians just simply ignore the fact that these cultures see them as being intermediate genders and reclassify them.
So what happened was they took these notions and effectively collapsed these varied activities into a framework which was necessarily Western. So they describe them as homosexual, even though they completely miss the subtleties, the indigenous understandings of these activities.
This fundamental misconception confuses our thinking now as much as it did in the colonial era. Dr. Shane Gannon.
There isn't the easy separation between sexuality and gender and sex that we assume in Western understandings of sexuality. So especially in the 19th century in the West, we separated those three. There's male and there's female. That's one separate category. There's gender, there's masculine and there's feminine. And then there's sexuality. And these are all three different analytical categories. That is not the experience of other groups.
Being hijra is much more beyond your sexual desires.
Abhina is quick to challenge the assumption that being hijra equates with homosexuality.
A lot of gay men been called as hijras, knowingly, unknowingly, because people don't see any big difference among them, but it is not the same. Hijras is much more different and unique than a gay man. If a gay man approaches me for a sexual act or even a relationship, I'll say, I'm sorry, I'm not interested.
And this has far-reaching consequences for those engaged in trying to construct a history of homosexuality.
Soon as you have this different embodiment, you're no longer a male, female, but you have something else in addition, suddenly the terms we have for sexuality fail. How can you have homosexuality when homo assumes two, or hetero assumes two? How can you understand sexuality in these contexts when you suddenly have a third? So our understanding of sexuality is fundamentally flawed in the South Asian context because we're trapped by our very language.
Does this discussion of gender categories belong in a history of homosexuality at all?
What we risk, just looking at the West and Western notions, is effectively reifying that as the norm, as the natural, and that's very, very dangerous.
If you say that you're talking about homosexuality, multiple genders doesn't have a place. If, on the other hand, you say what you're talking about is same-sex activities and same-sex relationships, then yes, it does belong, because then what you should be saying is some societies look at same-sex behavior, activities, individuals, and see asexuality. Other societies look at that and see a gender.
But the Western model pretty much buys into a fundamental binary about gender.
It does. It looks at, to be blunt, it looks at genitalia and sees gender. Other societies don't.
And there are rather literal illustrations of that from the early explorers.
William Bligh, for example, the infamous captain of the Bounty, puts on his white glove when he meets a Tahitian Mahu and puts his hand up the pareo, the skirt, of the transgender person of the Mahu that he encountered in Tahiti and describe what he was feeling, whether there were genitals there or not.
Professor Nico Besnier of the University of Amsterdam, an anthropologist who studied Polynesia. You could say Captains Cook and Bligh went out into the world curiously in the spirit of the Enlightenment. The missionaries who followed them, however, had a rather different attitude.
The London Missionary Society arrives in Tahiti in the late 1700s, if I remember correctly, 1799. And these people are Reformed Protestants, they are Puritans, and of course they are scandalized by the way they see. Not only is there transgender, which they call the unspeakable sexual practices, but they find infanticide, they find all sorts of practices that they all bundle together and say these people are dreadful heathens, they must be converted immediately.
In India, so in the South Asian context, Act 27 of 1871, Part 2 was called the Eunuch Act. In creating this law, there was a whole bunch of different groups that the British didn't like. It turns out it wasn't just the Hijra. There were a whole bunch of different groups. Anyone who cross-dressed, anyone who committed male-male sexual intercourse, anyone who was differently bodied, that would include eunuchs and hermaphrodites, all of these people were included under the Eunuch Act and therefore became considered Hijra. So you end up with this huge collapsing of categories in 1871.
But it wasn't just the British. In South America too, the conquistadors were determined to impose a rigid Western view.
They are obviously most shocked by human sacrifice. The second thing they're most shocked by is the fact that sodomy is openly practiced. The Spanish look at those societies and they see the most demonic, satanic societies that Christians have ever encountered. This then means that they will, if they convert them to Christianity, have triumphed over the most demonic and satanic cultures they've ever encountered. They obliterate as much of their writing as possible, so Aztec and Maya books are destroyed wholesale as quickly as they can get their hands on them, to disconnect these people from their past, from their histories, from their traditions, so that with a clean slate, they can fix them. For the Spanish, that's almost a godsend. In fact, they perceive of it as such. Here is their chance to win for Christianity, for Catholicism, people who have been utterly controlled and dominated by Satan.
Not very far from the British Museum in Bloomsbury in central London is Hoxton, which is one of those sort of liminal neighbourhoods between gentrified Islington and working class Hackney. And the museum here has a repository for some of the items that it can't show in its main building. And we've come to see one of them, and one that is particularly relevant for our story. a rather precious object to which I've been allowed special access. It records a dramatic, indeed tragic episode, and it gives us a revealing example of the multiple gender phenomenon. The storage facility is in a nondescript back street in a nondescript building, a world away from the impressive marble halls of the museum the public knows. Curator Max Carocci takes me up in a lift itself, something of a relic.
How many floors of stuff?
There's five floors.
And this is all stuff that you just don't have room to show in the museum?
The collections are, significantly larger than what the museum can display.
But the item I've come to see is here because it's particularly susceptible to degradation from light damage. It's a textile from the North American collection. Just coming into quite a large room, and round the edges there are desks and tables. In the centre, two tables put together. And on it, the object we've come to see, it's been unwrapped from tissue paper, and it's about the size of a large headscarf, plain, looks like cotton to me. And on it, there are drawn in what looks like sort of charcoal or graphite of some kind, figures, some of them coloured with red, but figures which are obviously telling the story of what was happening in the life of the culture that this object came from. Max, what is this we're looking at?
This is what is known as a winter count. A winter count is a chronological description of events that have happened over, in this case, more than 100 years among a particular tribe of Native North Americans. So it starts with the late 18th century and basically finishes the beginning of the 20th century.
And do we know which tribe where these Plains Indians were? This
particular winter count apparently comes from the Yankton-Yanktonai Dakota Indians of the northern plains of the United States.
Looking at these figures in the winter count at the edge, I mean, they're very simple, almost cartoonish. Some wearing headdresses, some with long hair, some with coloured garments. There's animals, there's horses.
Yes, there is a very important icon here where you see all these little crosses. Effectively, these are stars. This is the year when the stars fell. And a meteorite passed through the Dakota skies, and it was recorded as the year when the stars fell. Or episodes of epidemics, such in this case, where you see people with smallpox with all the dots on the body. This is a deer dance, for instance, where you can quite clearly make out the costume or the regalia used, worn by the deer dancers.
In all this sort of pageant of events and figures, there's one in particular that attracts our attention. It's on the inner spiral, and there's a figure, and it looks like a woman wearing a skirt with long hair, and she's standing in what looks like almost a sort of gibbet, because there's a cord from her neck hanging from one beam of the gibbet. It looks like someone either being hanged or hanging herself.
That is correct. In fact, this image depicts the suicide of a Winkte. It is a man-woman, a person called Grass, who killed herself by hanging. This must have happened around the latter part of the 19th century, that is 1890, 1891, and it shows in the icon the rope attached to her neck and what appears to be a structure. We don't know what kind of structure this was. And she chose that particular way of killing herself because it was the way in which women chose to end their life.
And what do we know about Winktes? What was their function within the group?
We know quite a lot about Winktes. Among the Dakota, this is a Dakota term that means once to be a woman, were considered almost like an in-between gender. That is, a gender that did not fall within the parameters of neither a man or a woman, and was virtually classified according to the tasks that he or she was performing. And I say he or she because sometimes we could have individuals of a female sex that would take on scales, occupations, and tasks of socially recognized men.
In the indigenous cultures of the Americas, it's very well documented that there was some form of multiple genders in almost every culture.
Professor Brian Gilley of Indiana University.
Whether you're talking about Mesoamerica, the Andes, the far northern parts of Canada, and there would be multiple genders, I think even more than what we have historically documented or what we've been able to fetter out of documents.
In Western cultures, such figures might often be seen as problematic by the majority. Was it difficult being a Winkte in a Dakota tribe, or was it something that had some sort of status?
It had a certain status, if anything, because in effect they were imbued with spiritual power. with a spiritual power that could not be recognized among generally accepted women or men. And so because of this particular status of this, you know, this spirituality associated with this figure, they had a special place, effectively, in the tribe. So they had specific ritual roles. They had specific roles in terms of matchmakers, for instance, between males and females. They were also organizing dances. They were organizing festivities.
It's interesting, almost as kind of non-combatants themselves, they became honest brokers in those sometimes complex social situations.
Absolutely. In fact, they were bringing together any number of things that can be brought together, extremes or opposites. And so effectively, they were almost encompassing both genders. They were transcending both genders. They were neither man nor woman, but both.
But how did one become a Winkte?
That person, as a child, would be watched. And if they showed a proclivity for sewing with their aunts or only wanting to hang out with women or interested in weaving or a kind of effeminity, then that child would be then socialized through the major rites of passage in life as a Winkte. So it was a gender role that was already established, and then an individual would then be socialized into that role. Now, how that manifested in sexuality is the puzzling thing.
We know from ethnohistorical sources that people of this category often were homosexuals, but not necessarily always so. In fact, in comparison to other tribes where similar figures existed, they could even have children.
When you say homosexual,
yes,
what do you mean?
Homosexual would, in this case, be a sexual contact between two bodies with the same genitalia.
Right. Can we kind of construct anything on that? Are there kind of issues around identity that might arise from that, or is that an impossible question to answer, indeed not proper to ask?
We tend to construct identity in accordance to both genitals and sexual proclivities. This is not necessarily the same with Native American tribes, especially Native American tribes of the historic period, that is before reservations. And that is because a sexuality or sexual proclivities or erotic desire did not actually make the person any particular identity. That is, so sexuality was effectively detached from their gender identity that these typologies of people may adopt.
Is this a particularly significant item in the collection, Max?
It is a very important object in the British Museum collections, if anything, because with regard to the history of lesbian and gay people, is one of the very few existing images drawn by the peoples themselves.
And it's an often overlooked fact that it wasn't simply those with male genitals who could be Winkte or other tribal equivalents.
The fact that male and female-bodied people had varied gender roles is something that scholars have fallen down on. We haven't done as much analysis on female-bodied persons. Historically, I think one of the reasons why we don't have as much historic interpretation is because people who were writing this stuff down weren't as interested in women living together, women seeming to be partners or whatever. I think that they were mostly focused on men having sexual relations or men living together. And so this was the abomination of all abominations. And so thus it was very well documented by priests who were on these expeditions and conquistadors and so forth.
Expeditions which ultimately led to the extinction of the practices, even among the Dakota tribe, which resisted the white man's advance longer than many others.
They are looking at this saying, this is an abomination. You know, you have male-bodied people sleeping together, married, cohabitating, so forth, and so having sex. And so they then went about systematically killing those people. So in most communities, except for a handful, it completely disappeared in the first couple hundred years of colonization.
In the case of the British, what's driving this desire to stamp out the diversity of forms of gender and sexual expression? In part, it was events nearer to home, for in France, as a result of the introduction of the Napoleonic Code in 1804, the act of sodomy was no longer a crime, and Frenchmen were now free to get up to same-sex stuff. Professor Bill Nafee.
I think it's worth remembering how incredibly violent the French Revolution appears to people who are watching it across the channel and trying to answer the question of what's wrong with these people? Why are they so seemingly insane as to want to turn the world upside down, one of the things that people latch onto is that they are utterly degenerate in their sexual mores. They have no sense of true morals of right and wrong, and they reject God and all of his works. A dangerous force, a degenerate force.
So the mood of intolerance abroad is mirrored by a new repressive climate at home. But the way the authorities seek to address this is paradoxical.
They begin to decrease the number of crimes for which death is a penalty. And one of the reasons they do that is they find that during the course of the middle of the 19th century, juries are increasingly unwilling to convict if the penalty is going to be death. So in actual fact, in an attempt to increase convictions, they effectively introduce the idea of gross indecency. That's what Oscar Wilde gets done for. The importance of that is it's much easier to convict someone for gross indecency than the previous charge of sodomy, which carried the death penalty. So you are much more likely after the middle of the 19th century to go to prison for gross indecency, i.e. for sexual relations with another man. And because it's on hard labour, the chances are you're not going to survive.
A new dimension here in the story of colonisation. Repression, certainly, but opportunities too. Professor Robert Aldrich of the University of Sydney.
Contrarywise, for some of the Europeans who were homosexual, those experiences, those discoveries of different sexualities overseas were emancipating. They showed that for some societies, the unnatural sin was rather natural, that what in Europe was considered a crime, an illness, a disease, was not so considered in the wider world.
In the wake of the Oscar Wilde trials, British society polarised, I think. You had labels like homosexual and heterosexual becoming fixed.
Professor Steph Newell has researched the life of John Murray Stuart Young, who claimed to have been at Wilde's bedside when he died. What a crowded scene that was. Although it's hard to rescue fact from fiction from this notably unreliable witness, Young's is an interesting commentary on the elusive nature of identity and homosexuality. He was born in a working-class area of Manchester in 1881 as plain John Young.
By the time he was 19, he'd established himself through embezzlement from his employer as a bourgeois literary gentleman, a young literary gentleman in a posh part of Manchester. So what we've got emerging here is somebody whose identity from the outset is multiple, complex, reinvented by himself, and particularly through forgery. So he ended up in prison at the age of 19, as he was found out, and he had 6 months with hard labour. And then he went to West Africa from there to start his life again.
Young fled partly because of his criminal notoriety, but also to escape escalating intolerance towards homosexuality back home in England.
Particularly as a working class young man, he constantly was trying to get away from those roots, not as a rejection of class, perhaps, but as a way to find himself sexually outside British labelling systems.
Young established himself as a very successful palm oil trader, visiting a number of Western African countries, but ending up in Nigeria, where Professor Steph Newell spoke to locals who remembered him.
There's a very interesting set of responses to Stuart Young when he arrived in Onitsha, which is a town. Then it was a very small trading post in eastern Nigeria. And the two sets of responses to him were very different because the white colonial observers of Stuart Young instantly identified him with a queer stereotype. However, Africans were also observing Stuart Young, this white man in their midst, and commenting on him, labelling him, naming him. And this is where his story becomes really interesting, because what we've got here is a reverse anthropological gaze. We've got Africans looking at Europeans, and this is something that's really often missed out of imperial histories, particularly histories of sexuality. What you have in Onitsha in the early 20th century is a whole set of names that accommodate Stuart Young's sexuality, marking him out as off the norm, but not into the framework of negative homosexuality. So one of the names for him was Mammy Water. Now, Mammy Water is the mermaid from the River Niger, and is an association with the spirit realm. So Stuart Young was said to be married in the water, married to Mammy Water. And Mammy Water is a figure who would marry mortals. And often, when you marry Mammy Water, you exchange fertility for wealth. And very much it's the label associated with those wealthy market women who became extremely wealthy through trade, but didn't have children themselves.
So what do we know of indigenous practices in this period?
Stuart Young himself wrote about local sexualities quite openly. And in fact, allegedly, in one of the documents by Stuart Young that's recently come to light, allegedly D.H. Lawrence pestered Stuart Young for exactly that kind of material that Stuart Young refused to give him. But basically what it means is that you've got rituals, customs, traditions, dances, all kinds of local expressions of a non-Western, non-Christianized sexuality, whether that is homosexuality or polyamorous sexuality or however you would label it, that are resisting the scholarly quest to discover them. They're resisting our description, that they're falling away from our effort to recapture and label them. Elusive in the same way, perhaps, that homosexuality is and remains elusive.
There is evidence, also ambiguous, of same-sex activity among women in parts of Africa. Professor Mark Aprecht of Queen's University, Ontario.
If you go to the ethnography that started to be written from the late 19th century, it crops up time and time again that different people referred to different types of same-sex relationship, and they explained it in ways. For example, a common one was a woman would be possessed by a male ancestor, right? So the male ancestral spirit is there in the woman. And so obviously she can't marry a man, right? There would be the male spirit marrying a man. No, he can't have that. So she would stay either celibate, or she may take a female wife. So that was there, and vice versa. It could be a man who has a female ancestral spirit.
But loath to leave him, what can we conclude from the story of John Murray Stuart Young?
I think it reveals the problem of labelling. I think it reveals how, in spite of labels being so freeing, if you've got too few labels, then you have got a problem. So the story of Stuart Young, to me, is an illustration of the need for multiple labels for our complex and multiple sexualities.
Leaving aside Young's criminal tendencies, that process of reinvention will be familiar to many gays and lesbians today, who still move from small towns to big cities, sometimes across continents, to find a more accepting and congenial way of life. But of course you need the economic means to do so. In India, a new Bollywood movie about hijras. Queens, Destiny of Dance, directed by David Atkins, tells the story of a young dancer. A highly dramatic affair, it seeks to portray hijras sympathetically. For although there are around a million in India today, hijras are a marginalised community. Abina Aher.
So you see a lot of these hijras on signals asking for money because they do not have a full-fledged job.
And many are forced into sex work.
There are a lot of hijras who get raped, and there are a lot of hijras who get killed when they are doing a sex work. I have seen lot and lot of hijras being killed because they do sex work in the night, pitch dark in the night. A car just dashes them and goes away without even recognizing. Police is not bothered about hijras because who are these people? I mean, they don't have social entitlement, they don't have social recognition, and they do not even have a social acceptance.
Has the legalization of homosexuality in India helped the hijra cause in any way?
In society right now, after the decriminalization of Section 377, being gay is considered to be a classy. Being gay is considered to be a metrosexual, but being transgender is, being hijra is not. Because I remember my mother, when I came out to my mother and I some years before, and I told her that I'm a hijra, and she ended up saying that is, why can't you be just gay? Why do you have to be a hijra? So you can imagine, you know, the kind of self-ashame even a family faces for their son being a hijra, because hijras are not well-treated in a society. Hijras are not well-recognized in a society, and hijras are not well-respected in a society right now.
The incidence of HIV among hijras, as in other marginalised groups, is extremely high. Abina campaigns to raise awareness.
Last month, I did a sensitization for around 450 parliamentary members, and Prime Minister and Sonia Gandhi, everybody was there. And I talked about hijra issues. And I said that the first question I asked them is that, can you see me? Can you see me? And they all said, yes, we can see you. Why are you asking this question? I said, no, but in social context, you don't see me. You only see a man and a woman. Not good.
Hijras aren't recognised as such by Indian law, and officialdom can be slow to acknowledge them. This can infringe basic democratic rights.
My male name was Abhijit, and now I'm Abhina. Right now, whatever identification I have, whenever I travel, I have to travel with a male identity. So I struggle. Whenever I travel by airport, they look at my ID card and they said, you look like a woman, but you have a name, Abhijit. But that's what the real struggle is. How am I supposed to access my health? What is about my social entitlement? I do not even have a basic documentation. I do not have... You are talking about these 20 lakh people who do not have right to vote in your country? What are you talking about?
And this comes at a cost.
At this point of time, we see around 60 to 70% of HIV prevalence among hijras. A lot of hijras are dying. And these hijras are not only affecting themselves, but they are also affecting the general population. We are scared.
Elsewhere, though, the picture is rather different. In the Polynesian islands, for instance, the reverse is true. Anthropologist Professor Nico Besnier from the University of Amsterdam.
You have a sort of an ironic situation in which parents will tell their boy who declares to them, I'm gay, they will say things like, don't come to me and say you're gay. You can be a fafafine if you want, but not gay.
In Polynesia, homosexual identities are marginalised in favour of traditional third gender identities, which are still very much embraced by the community.
Enormous acceptance, which in fact surprises many people who visit those islands to see how natural it is to have amongst one's friends in those societies one of these boys who are really girls. And they're particularly visible, for example, to visitors. An average visitor will arrive in Tonga and immediately come across at the flower shop, at the car rental agency, at the bus station, transgender people. Transgender Polynesians are brokers. They're brokers between the present and the future, between their societies and the outside world.
According to Professor Besnier, there's a quite simple reason why the church in Tonga tolerates this traditional practice.
If you ask a whakarite in Tonga, why do pastors not condemn you? They say, well, if they do, we'll remind them of their youth.
After the arrival of the white man in native North America, multiple gender was firmly suppressed. But in the past 15 years, it's been revived under the umbrella term two-spirit. If you're a Native American growing up today, you may choose to be gay in the modern Western sense or two-spirit in the traditional sense. But here's the question. Is two-spirit a gender identity or a sexual identity by another name? How easy is it to make sense of multiple genders in a world where sexual identity takes precedence? Professor Brian Gilley of Indiana University.
Anytime someone comes to know themselves as two-spirit, it's initially through that experience of desiring someone else of the same bodily sex or of having a desire to be transgender. And so it's almost always through the lens of desire that someone comes to know themselves initially, at least, as two-spirit.
And there's another tension here between the individualism of now and a traditional idea of community.
Today, to identify yourself as two-spirit is a choice, or it's a choice to frame your experience as a Native American and as someone who desires someone else of the same sex in a particular way. Historically, to fulfill that role was more complex in that it didn't have this one-to-one association with sexuality that it does today. And so historically, the community decided, your parents or your aunts and uncles or your grandmother or whatever decided to socialize you in a particular way. So yes, that was a community decision. And today, it being more of an individual decision, it's really more about how you decide to frame these multiple intervening identities that you have.
This particularly comes into focus in cultures where sexual and gender identities haven't been reshaped so much by Western values, especially our kind of individualism. In Polynesia, for example, third gender is still seen as a community asset. Professor Nico Besnier.
Well, we're the ones in the West, in industrial societies, that have somehow developed this notion of what Anthony Giddens calls the pure relationship. In other words, a relationship in terms of which we identify ourselves with one other person, which forms, if you wish, the unit of cohesion, the unit of analysis of the of modern society. Most of the world continues for most of the world, the unit of cohesion continues to be the kinship group.
In general, we have this idea of Native Americans as liberal humanists, but they weren't. They lived in a highly structured, highly conservative society because their survival depended on it. And so the individual was a lot less important historically than it is now. So part of that decision to identify as two-spirit now as an individual decision somewhat doesn't translate to historic times when the individual or individual will or free will basically didn't exist.
Up to a point. Back to Grass, the Winkte who took her own life in 1890. I asked Max Carocci why.
Because she had problems with her beloved, and she was left by her beloved, and therefore found no better solution than killing herself, because her lover left her.
This is an affecting little scene to see recorded on this kind of grey piece of cloth in what looks like kind of rough charcoal or pencil. This figure, in distress, rope around her neck, his neck, fastened to this gibbet. And it's one of those things that you see with a sort of, well, what might be called a sharp, tender shock, a moment of recognition among figures which in other ways seem very mysterious to us. The reaction I felt more than once in the making of this series is to look at something that comes from a culture that's very far away and distant in time too, and seeing something with a moment of recognition. I was thinking the same thing looking at the hieroglyphics in the tomb of the philosopher T in Saqqara, and seeing some sailor shouting sexual, homophobic, anachronistic language abuse at another sailor. All of a sudden you get a moment where it kind of stands out and you sort of recognise something familiar in your own experience, an experience that actually comes from hundreds or even indeed thousands of years ago.
Next week, we ask if the global promotion of gay rights by Western powers is an attempt to right one of the wrongs of the colonial project, or is it a continuation of the colonial project? And as third-gendered, two-spirited people get drawn into that political and cultural narrative, might equality come at the cost of diversity?
The colonial construction of sexuality, so the Western notion, was attempted to be imposed onto a variety of different places, and it always failed. Because sexuality is slippery. It never quite maps on nicely. And I think the one thing that the Hijra have in common with all the different other third genders is they resist our understanding of sexuality. They represent something different that allows us to question who we are.
Out in the World is presented by Richard Coles. The series consultant is Professor Bill Nafee, and the producer was Lawrence Grizel. The final programme in the series is tomorrow night at the same time, 10 o'clock, here on BBC Radio 3. A few words now from Ian McMillan.
Words and music go rather well together, and great music often inspires great words. Radio 3 has proved that over the years. There's no finer inspiration than the 2012 BBC Proms season. And this year, we're inviting you to take part in the 2012 BBC Proms Poetry Competition.